Hey, what's going on, Dutch Nation? Today on the podcast, we've got legacy franchisee of Anderson, Palisadro, and Redding, California, Mr. Chris Reznor. Rez was on our podcast back in 2014, but we decided to call him up because a lot's happened since then. And this is kind of a heavy episode. We really wanted to connect with Reznor and just see how the community of Redding is doing after that really devastating fire a couple months back, which caused almost 40,000 people to evacuate their homes. His wife, Erin, was just elected to city council, and they're just really putting so much effort into trying to revitalize Redding and just make it an awesome place. And man, it's just crazy. Paradise, California, is a fire they're dealing with just a little bit after what Redding's gone through. And just a huge shout out to Matt Long and Chico Dan and Hai Hong and all their efforts right now in trying to do what they can to serve all those people that have lost their homes and lost so much. Our hearts, our prayers, our thoughts are definitely with you guys. Keep sending them that Dutch love. And hopefully we'll get to connect with you at some point when everything starts to settle a little bit. We really hope it does. But with that being said, we love the Reznors. We love you guys. Sit back, relax, enjoy the Chris Reznor podcast.
So since 2014, you're up to six stands in Redding, one in Palisadro and one in Anderson. You've also had two more children. So just give us a little summary of those accomplishments and some of the joys and the wins and the struggles that have like gone down since the last time you've been on.
Geez, over 4 years ago, eight total stands. We're up to almost 300 employees now. In our immediate family, yeah, we have three kids now. Beckett is nine. Rowley is four. And Maven, our little girl, is just over a year and a half. She's at that weird age where I'm not quite sure how to say how old she is. It's like The past sort of the months, but she's not two. But the last few years have been crazy. Erin just got elected for city council.
No way! That's sick! And
that's awesome.
Yep. Tonight is the official swearing in, and then her first city council meeting is tonight. So at 6 o'clock, she gets like officially sworn in. Like a bunch of our employees are going and stuff, and we're just going to kind of do a little hangout, and then she has like her official first city council meeting.
Wow.
Wow. What was her motivation and desire to take that beast on?
I mean, I think like a lot of towns, we have struggles, and there's been a lot of struggles probably in the last 5 years in Redding. It's just ramped up, and a lot of it's based around similar kind of stuff to Southern Oregon, but a lot of drug problems and mental illness. And Our town is just kind of going through some low points. We're on like the top 10 lists in the country for like negative things, like worst place for your car to get stolen, or most break-ins, or most domestic violence. And So it's just like we're making all these lists of negative things. But when you live here, it's like, man, we have such a beautiful town and a beautiful community. I've been here for 16 years now, and Erin was pretty much born and raised here. She moved here when she was like 6 months old. We have the mountains and the rivers and lakes and all this beauty. It's just an amazing place that we have a lot of pride in. And for the last 15 years, we've been pouring into our community with Dutch in every possible way we can. And I think it's one of those things where Erin looked at it and was like, man, I can only sit on the sidelines and do what we're doing for so long. Like, I feel like I can make more of an impact if I play a bigger role. And she's never been like somebody that's want to be like a politician. It's like, I want to do this because I feel like I really can help. You know, she's learned a lot in the last 15 years about putting teams together. And it's not about getting people on the bus. It's about getting the right people on the bus and then putting them in the right seats. And I think that, you know, that's something that Erin has developed a skill for in our operation in the last 14 years since we've been open, is really building good teams and structure. And there's no one person that can make a difference in our city, but it's being able to get people on the same page and leaving like egos at the door. That's what she has a passion for. And I think that that's where she's going to make a big difference in our community.
Dude, well, that's awesome. Yeah. That's exciting. And it's cool to see people getting into it for that reason, just wanting to make positive, effective change and not just be like, oh, well, I want to be president someday, so let's just do this.
Yeah, totally.
So, I mean, mentioning some of the issues Redding's had and just wanting to make it a better place, obviously the whole Pacific Northwest has been just getting hit with devastating fires. We all know what's happening in Paradise right now, but prior to that, Redding got hit crazy hard. What was going through your mind when literally you're watching the flames engulf your town?
It was crazy. So we live on the west side of Reading, and we have recently moved over here probably a year ago. It was a Wednesday night, and it was like 2 days after the fire had started, and nobody was really talking about it because it was on the other side of Whiskeytown, which from my house, as the crow flies, has got to be at least 10 miles.
Yeah.
It started on like Monday, and then Tuesday, it was like 2,000 acres or something. And and Wednesday night, everybody's asleep, and I was getting ready to go to bed, and it was like almost midnight. Look out my front door, just check on the cars before I go to sleep. And it looks like it's snowing outside. And so I'm like, I go outside, and there's full-on leaves and stuff falling in our yard. I'm like, whoa, this is a lot of ash for how far the fire is away.
Yeah.
So I walked out into the middle of the street, and I look kind of the northwest, and I can see flames on the hill way out there. They're far, far away, but I can still actually see flames. And so nobody's talking about this. This is kind of a big deal. Yeah. And so I took a picture of it, and I came in, and I woke Erin up. I'm like, hey, check this out. And so she got up and came outside, and we're like standing in the middle of our street at midnight and talking about it. We're like, this is a little close. So we stayed up for like an hour and a half, and we loaded up our cars with all of our valuables, like pictures and just stuff that we didn't want to lose if it would burn. Because for me, I'm like, man, it's not going to hit our area, but I don't want to be that family like, you know, those families in Santa Rosa and that happened last year where they're like running out of their house, grabbing their thing.
Yeah.
I'm like, let's just pack up our stuff and be safe. And
they're safe than
and,
sorry.
Totally. So we went to sleep, and I didn't sleep very well. But by Thursday morning, the fire had grown to like 15,000 acres. Man. And everybody was like, oh, man, this is actually coming to Reading. And so I just kind of hung out all day. We kind of canceled everything. We moved our cars, and we got the rest of our things that were important to us. So by Thursday night, it was like coming to Reading. I mean, you could see it was crazy. I think it was about 7:30 p.m. Our street is kind of like the street that is like the barrier into Reading. And there's a valley leading up to our neighborhood. And so I was at the end of our street with probably 20 firemen watching the fire come across this valley. And finally they were like, hey, this is going to hit the neighborhood and it's going to be nasty. Everybody needs to leave.
Man.
So I went and I'm like sitting in my driveway just watching, like there's highway patrol and Reading Police Department, and there's fire trucks whipping up and down our street. There's helicopters pulling water out of the river. And I'm like, oh my gosh, this is like surreal.
Yeah.
You know, and I remember kind of stood in my garage for a second. I'm like, man, is there anything else that I'm forgetting that I need? And so I got in my car and I'm just like, all right, well, I guess my house is going to be gone. And so I got in my car, and Beckett and Maven were already at Doug and Michelle's, because Doug and Michelle live on the east side of Reading out towards Palisadro. So that's where we had taken all of our stuff.
Yeah.
Erin and Rally left just before me, and they drove up and down the neighborhood and kind of prayed for all the houses as they were leaving. And then finally I got in my car and drove out of the neighborhood, and kind of a crazy feeling because the fire was literally a eighth of a mile away at that point. And it was this crazy, huge fire tornado. They were calling it this like fire-nado. There was firemen that had been involved in fires for, you know, 20 years. And they said they'd never seen something like this. And the winds that had happened because of this, there was actually a fireman that was killed. It picked his truck up and threw it like 100 yards and killed him. And so it was just this crazy stuff. And you could see this big fire tornado like coming towards our neighborhood. And so I remember we left and I went out to Doug and Michelle's house, and I got out there and it was probably 8:15 or 8:30 or so at night. And I remembered that I had cameras at my house, like exterior security cameras. And so I got on my phone to kind of see what was going on. And so I first checked it and everything looked good. Like there's just some fire trucks and stuff. So about 10 minutes later, I got on and checked again. And the yard across the street from my house was on fire.
Ugh.
And my neighbor's yard was on fire. And I could see it on my cameras, and I'm like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
And the end of the street, you could kind of see towards the end of the street where the fire hit, and it was just like all blown out in brightness. Like the whole thing looked like it was on fire.
Man.
And I'm just thinking, wow. And then the cameras went dead.
Oh.
So like, all right, well, there it goes. Our house is gone. And you never really know if like how you're going to feel in that position. I felt okay. I mean, I got all the things that Erin and I cared about the most, and we were safe. Everybody that we knew of was safe at that point. And so it was just kind of like, well, this is what we have insurance for, you know, and
sure,
we're going to lose it and we'll deal with it later. Then it turned more to like, all right, that's our situation. But now what about all these people? Because this is going to be bad. This is going to affect a lot of people. If it was to go through our neighborhood, it could be bad. I mean, it could really hit a lot of neighborhoods in Redding, kind of like what happened with Paradise. And it was pretty wild.
Yeah, when something like that happens, I mean, it affects the entire community. Were there some people on your crew that were affected more than others? And like, how were you able to help and give that support needed for them? But just, you know, what did Dutch Bros do for that community? Like, what did it mean for them?
Well, one thing that I noticed in the days after, Redding is a community of about 100,000 people.
Yeah.
And I really felt like, you know, with all the stuff I was saying earlier about how there's so much negativity about Redding right now, it really felt like a small town. Yeah. I mean, everybody was coming out of the woodworks trying to figure out how they could help each other, how we could help the community. For Aaron and I, there's so many different levels to it because, you know, you got your personal life. We were out of our home for a week, which was also kind of funny. We got evacuated. And for me, when we were packing up all our stuff to leave, I didn't really grab any clothes or anything because I was like, all right, house is going to burn down. Aaron's in the background listening. She's like, I'm grabbing the wine.
Some of those fancy bottles you've been stashing for a while.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And my mountain bike. And so it's like, you don't really think about what happens if your house doesn't burn down, but you can't get into it. So I only grabbed like a pair of shorts and a t-shirt and like one pair of underwear, I think. Yeah. And so, you know, our house didn't burn down, but we couldn't get back into our neighborhood for a week.
Right.
So, I mean, I'm wearing recycled clothes just like everybody from like our warehouse, the old Dutch Bros clothes and stuff.
Oh, crazy.
But, you know, it really made our town come together and people really had each other's backs and it just felt like it was all this big positive movement. So that was Thursday night that it really hit Redding. Everybody started getting evacuated. You know, like I said, there's 100,000 people. I think 38,000 people were evacuated.
Yeah. Man.
Yeah, which is wild. I mean, over a third of our community was evacuated from their homes for some amount of time. Yeah. So for our crew, that Thursday night, I mean, we essentially closed all our stands because our crew, they were getting evacuated from their homes. So they were at work and they were getting evacuation notices. So they're like, I need to leave. And you're like, yeah, go.
Yeah.
Like, we'll just close all the stands. So we closed everything. And then we were just trying to figure out what to do. Nobody knew if their homes were burned or if they were okay. Like, people were getting evacuated from all over town. That next day, Aaron and I wanted to kind of drive over that direction and see if we could somehow get to our house. Cause I got reports throughout the night from firefighter friends of mine that said that the house was still standing, but there was neighbors' homes that were on fire that were currently burning. And so we're like, all right, well, it's good. Our house is still there, but we're not out of the forest yet.
Yeah.
And so we wanted to drive over there to kind of see if we could get in. And I noticed that when we went by our downtown stand, our manager and assistant manager were there because McDonald's delivered all the stock. And so, so we were closed, but then they got the call like, hey, McDonald's is here waiting for you. McDonald's didn't know what was going on. And so my manager and assistant manager showed up to like put all the stock away. And so Aaron and I are, oh shoot, we're like in our, you know, pajamas and stuff. So we went down there to help, just try to see if we could help put stock away and help them out. However, and we were inside and across the street, there's like 75 firemen because there was firemen coming in from all over Northern California at that point.
Yeah.
And there was a bunch of firemen across the street in this restaurant parking lot and just standing there. And so we're like, God, we got to make those guys some drinks. We hollered over at them like, come on over. We'll make you guys drinks. And so they all came over. We hooked all these dudes up with drinks. And in doing so, it looked like we were open because of how many people were there. So customers started pulling in and got in line. And all of a sudden, just slammed. Like, we had 20 cars in line.
Crazy.
We had me and Aaron and a manager and assistant manager.
Oh,
and
my goodness.
As much as I want to say I work in the stand still, I don't.
Right.
So, like, I know how to make a drink still, but I was, like, on window just giving everything away. And people didn't know, so they just pulled up, and they're like, oh, man, I'm glad you guys are open. And we're like, well, I mean, technically we're not open, but, like, yeah, we're open.
Yeah.
And then they went to pay, and we're like, hey, don't even worry about it. We don't have any of our iPads up here. Like, just here, it's on us.
Yeah.
And so we did that, and we started calling in, putting out SOS, like, hey, we need some backup down here because we're, like, open now. And we're slammed. So all the other stands are closed. That stand turned into being open.
Yeah.
And so we just started pulling on whoever from our crew was still in town because most of our crew that got evacuated, they left town.
Sure.
So they went to like friends' houses in Oregon or they went down south or wherever. Like, understandably, they went to wherever they could. And so whoever was still in town, either not evacuated or people that were in town that just wanted to help, the first focus at that point was to just staff that stand because we started realizing that everywhere was closed. So there wasn't like any businesses open. Mm-hmm. So we were really the only one open. And we started seeing like, man, people are freaking out that we're open.
Yeah.
Because it's just like a little piece of normalcy. They're so unbelievably appreciative that we're open. So we just stayed open. Everything was free for a couple days. And then as people on our crew started kind of trickling back into town, we started slowly adding some shifts at other stands. So everybody evacuated to the east. So Palisadro, we should open it because there's a bunch of people out there.
Yeah.
And so we would open it from like 9 a.m. to 2 p.m.
Sure.
And just as whatever we could staff over the next week, we started adding shifts and stands. And you know, you asked about how it affected certain people on our crew as opposed to others. I think we had like probably 10 of our employees that lost their homes.
Man.
And that was a whole different thing. And by the time they realized that their home was gone and they had a support system in place, we tried to help however we could and just offering like, hey, whatever you need, we're here for you to help. The thing that was neat to see for our crew was how much fulfillment they got from being able to help in our community. Because everybody wants to help in a like a disaster situation, but usually there's really no outlet for that. You're trying to figure out like, man, I wish I could help, but there's not like a resource that just is like, hey, I want to help. Here's some ways that you can help. So for us to be able to provide an outlet for our crew to be able to volunteer in different areas, a lot of our crew have said that that was the most impactful thing in their Dutch Bros career and in their life that they've been a part of, was being able to contribute to just the joy that it brought to our community and having us there. And that looked like, you know, us taking our van and setting up at the evacuation centers and just serving drinks to those people, bought like 10 ice chests and stocked them with cold brew and Rebel and water, and sent those ice chests out to the front lines, either in the fire camps or there was like National Guard in town and there was CHP.
Yeah, it was a full state of emergency. Yeah.
Basically, it turned into like, how can we get drinks into every possible person's hands in town, whether they're evacuated or they're first responder helping.
Mm-hmm.
And so for our crew, they just, I mean, they freaked out being able to help out with that. We had a camp set up at PG&E's base camp, which was 2,000 people on 60 acres. Mm-hmm. With this huge camp set up. We had a little shop set up there serving drinks to them. And yeah, it was really neat to just see our crew get their hearts filled by pouring out to other people.
Yeah.
It was neat to see how Dutch Bros headquarters helped out with that. You guys sent us pallets of water, sent us pallets of cold brew and Rebel.
Yeah.
So that was really cool to see that stuff show up. Trav sent both of his big old crazy fifth wheel trailers.
Yeah.
We had those set up at our warehouse. And so that was a resource that we had for a number of our employees, took advantage of that.
I came down with Jameson when we brought down those trailers because we were there for Coach Asak. And then on our way back up through, I was just like, oh my gosh, like couldn't see 10 feet in front of you. And
yeah,
it was wild.
Yep. Most people will never or have never experienced something like that, you know, and knowing how it affected our community and then seeing Paradise now, it's just, it's mind blowing. Their stand survived, but that they're closed. Like it's just the whole town is closed up.
Yeah. But they still can't get power or anything. It's bonkers.
Yeah.
So now what would you say is like the current state of Redding as a whole now that it's been a few months since that freaking beast?
You know, it's interesting because I don't want to say that everybody has like moved on because it's still a topic of conversation. It burned, I think, 1,100 homes in our area, which pales in comparison to Paradise now. But, you know, our house ended up surviving. When you come into my neighborhood, those 17 of our neighbors' homes burned,
man,
which is kind of crazy. It's like a daily reminder because we drive through that part of our street every day.
Yeah.
The whole street's gone. And so, you know, they've really done a good job in getting lots clean. Redding really tried to learn from the Santa Rosa area from their experience because they've taken a lot longer to recover.
Mm-hmm.
And so for our community, really trying to not extend people's, you know, cleanups of their homes any longer than they should be. I think in our city limits, there's like 228 homes that burned.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them were in the county. 220 of the lots are already all cleaned. So
oh,
they
good.
Came in,
good.
FEMA came in or private entities came in and and bulldozed everything and cleaned up the lots. And so there's still that daily reminder in some areas. And there was a couple neighborhoods that were completely gone. I mean, they look like war zones from the Middle East. But I feel like that our community is tighter from that. And there's a lot of focus on how we can rebuild and a lot of focus on some of the beautiful areas of our town that were destroyed. So like the trail systems and some of that stuff that's on the west side of town. I think it's going to take years to fully recover, but I think it's brought our community closer together.
Kind of dovetailing off that, I know you've been super instrumental in setting up the park, which basically it's this cool spot downtown, like a courtyard. You got a bunch of food trucks and cornhole and games and activities. And it's sort of like a safe place too, where families can gather, just hang out, have a good time. It's kind of revitalizing that part of town. So what sparked that in you to want to get involved with setting that whole thing up?
It sort of started about a year and a half ago when a guy named Todd Franklin, who is the men's basketball coach at Simpson College here in town, he had this vision of wanting to do like a food truck park kind of thing like he'd seen in some other cities, particularly in Bend.
Yeah.
And came in, he was talking with the building department a bunch and, you know, like trying to identify maybe a piece of the city's property that was in need of repair that maybe he could utilize for something like this. And so about that same time, connected with me and Aaron to basically just kind of pick our brains, because he had this vision, but he didn't really know much about the vending side, like with food trucks and selling things and maybe what vendors could pay or food trucks could pay. Sure. And so he kind of gave us this whole pitch on his vision. And of course, it seemed really, really cool. And we kind of hit it off. He's a great guy. And so we just kind of believed in the vision of it and helped however we could with answering questions. And he had a lot of roadblocks to go through with ABC, which is alcohol beverage control in California, with the license and with this hotel that was a neighboring hotel to this property. It's this park in downtown Reading. It's called Library Park or Carnegie Park, and it has a long history in Reading. There used to be a library on it in the early 1900s, and it just ended up getting taken over by junkies. And so there was just drugs and tweakers there all the time and fights, and it just was a dangerous place. It's a really neat spot, but it was just let go. And so that was a property that Todd identified as wanting to work with, and the city was down with it. And so he had this local architect that's super talented draw up some really cool plans for it with this big multi-level decking and metal and concrete and like fire pits. And when it finally got approved, Todd called me and he's like, "Hey, you got to come check this out. I got the plans. Come down here to the park. I want to show you it." So I'm like, "Okay." So I went down there, showed me the plans, and it's like super killer. And he's like, "I want you to be partners in this with me." I'm like, "Whoa, wait, what?" You know, yeah. So at first, you know, anytime somebody says that, you're like, "All right, you know, how much money are you wanting?"
Right.
And he's like, no, it's not about the money. Like, that might come. I'm probably going to need money, but I don't necessarily need that right away. He goes, "I want you and Aaron to be a part of this because of what you guys bring to it with your place in the community and with what you've learned with Dutch Bros and with people and with hiring." And our reason for jumping in on it was there's this major push to revitalize downtown, probably one of the most well-known bad areas in town. Yeah. And how cool is it if we can come in and help take this over? It's a little snapshot of what we can do with our whole community.
Totally.
And we met with them several times and finally said yes and decided to be a part of it. And we opened the end of September, and we've just seen like raving reviews from this place. I mean, first night we opened, we did just kind of like a VIP night where we invited tons of people from our community that we felt like ran in different circles, and we wanted to get everybody there and just kind of introduce it to them. And
yeah,
we had a huge turnout that night. People loved it. And then the next night we had our grand opening, and we had probably 1,000 people show up.
Wow.
And
sick.
It's unbelievable. Like, we had all these food trucks, we got music, we really put a lot of thought into everything, and we got like bulb lighting all over the place, and we got this wooden bowling alley that we had built, huge oversized checker game and cornhole and just yard games. And so to see how quickly something like this could change by just putting time and pouring your heart and of course money into something like this, to see what it can do in our community has been amazing. Kind of the cross section of our society that has been there. It's like everybody from young people to kids, to families with kids, to old folks and doctors, and every part of our community shows up and enjoys this place. And it's been really neat to be a part of.
I've seen it, man. It's super polished and people seem to have responded really well to it. And You know, I think that's just what everybody, young and old, wants, is their community to be healthy and to have places to congregate and just, you know, break bread and have a drink and play some games and just feel safe and feel together. So, like, super sick that you guys did that.
I mean, that's really been our focus since day one, is our community and how can we make our community a better place. So these are like natural progressions to try to make more of an impact in our city, is how else can we help make our city cool.
Going into 2019, where do you want to see Dutch Bros Reading?
You know, I think just a continued focus on operations and running our organization as a thriving, successful business. Mm-hmm. I think that's the one thing, you know, you go through all these like 8 stages of maturity like a kid. We opened Churn Creek in 2004 and it was super crazy and we're doing things like nobody had seen as far as sales, and you just kind of had to learn and adapt and grow. And we didn't care about anything other than getting drinks to customers and training people.
Yeah.
And then over time, if we grew from 1 to 2 stands and then to 5 stands, and I tried to sort of be the manager of all 5 stands because we didn't have any money because we grew so fast. And and then all of a sudden you realize like, well, shoot, we're doing such huge volume because we have so many stands. We need to start paying attention to some of these things like payroll and COGS. Otherwise, we're going to fail no matter how great our culture is.
Totally.
And so I think that for us is, you know, the size we're at now is just trying to be good stewards with the money that's coming in and knowing that we have 300 people relying on us to provide them with a work environment. You know, if we're terrible managers of the money that's coming in, we're going to fail and our people are going to be out of jobs and the impact in our community will cease from that aspect. Totally.
You've got a rich history of developing some pretty amazing leaders, Randall and Fleck, who went on to franchise, but also people at HQ, Ian Brooks, Rachel Lahore, you know, came under your leadership. It's pretty impressive, man. You've groomed up some quality people. So, I mean, what were some of the resources that you provided them in kind of mentoring them and helping them get to the next step and achieve their goals?
You know, you named a lot of the people, and there was roughly 15 people that either work at HQ or have franchise or are currently operators.
Yeah.
One of our guys, Skyler, he's taken off. Him and his wife are leaving, I think, next week.
Yeah, I don't think he knows it yet, but we're planning on having him on here on the hot
seat.
Right.
That's awesome. Dude, we just had a big going away Christmas dinner sort of thing for all of our managers and assistant managers the other night. And it's just a refreshing thing to see something like that because, you know, we pour all this time and effort and money into leadership development. And so every time one of these guys gets promoted, so to speak, it's like a proud parent moment, you know. And I think some of the things that we probably do that go above and beyond, we've had a leadership coach that has worked with our people for the last few years. His name's Matt Klutz. He's kind of been around some of the Dutch world in the last few years. He came to one of the entree leadership things and had some good talks with Trav. And he is just an amazing dude. He used to work at Simpson, started his own leadership development company. He's good friends with Fleck, so that probably makes sense because Fleck has a lot of talent.
Yeah.
He's really immersed himself in our culture, and so he can relate to our people like probably like nobody else that's not a Dutch Bros employee. He doesn't work for Dutch Bros, nor has he ever, but he understands every single challenge that our people face. You know, when you really sit back and think that you're putting major leadership roles in very thriving businesses, you're putting that responsibility on people that some of them are just out of high school.
Yeah.
Maybe they kill it in the stand as a barista, but it doesn't necessarily mean they understand how to lead a team of people. And totally. So we've brought somebody on that helps with that. And, you know, Aaron and I meet with them, and then our managers meet with them, assistant managers meet with them, and then our, which we call SQBs, shift quarterbacks, which are just shift leads, they meet with them. Our managers and assistant managers have a big training with them once a month, and usually that looks like him getting them all together. He picks a topic to talk about. I mean, it's stuff that all of our people deal with. You know, it's conflict resolution, and he'll do role playing with them and help coach them through situations maybe before they have to have tough talks with people. And we've just seen massive growth from that. I mean, as much as I would love to say that I could be that guy, I could pour into my people a lot, but I don't have the time and attention to be able to do that when I'm trying to run as big of an operation as we're doing.
Yeah.
And so for me to be able to have somebody that I can rely on to be that guy is pretty amazing. And I feel like he's probably the biggest source of growth with our people, with that sort of thing, with mentorship and stuff.
That's really cool. I mean, we're still very much focused on growing within and giving our people the best possible opportunity to grow with us. But it's definitely not a bad thing to pull people excelling in other areas into our world as well, get so much insight mm-hmm. and wisdom from them. So, dude, that's sick.
Yeah, for sure. Kudos.
You gave us that infamous clean the little spot under the steam wand quote as advice for those night guys that want to move up in the company. Why was that such a impactful thing for you to see as a franchisee?
Yeah. I remember when I met Kyle Garrett, I remember Brant introduced me to him. And, you know, just a little young whippersnapper. And I'm just a normal dude like everybody else. And you're put on the spot to, come up with something amazing. And I'm like, dude, that's all I got. And for me, though, I think that really it means something bigger. I mean, it's everything we talk about. Everybody in our company talks about magic in the details. And that's an example of that. I mean, anybody can make the simple things shine in the shop and, pick up trash and clean the floor real quick and wipe the counters off and maybe do some crazy milk tin stack so that the morning people come in and they're like, well, look at how those milk tins are stacked up. Mm-hmm. But to really pay attention to cleaning the details. And I think that for me, that was my biggest thing is if I walk in a stand and everything looks all sharp and polished, but you walk right over to the machine and you look underneath the milk steam area and it's filthy. Okay. This guy didn't do that good of a job because he didn't pay attention to the details. So I can guess probably 15 other things in the shop that are probably dirty also. Honestly, to really simplify everything, one word, and it's care. Just care.
Yeah.
That's all you need to do is care. And if you care about whatever it is that you're doing, it's going to show.
Piggybacking off that, if you could just give one other piece of advice to all those young baristas out there, what would it be?
You know, I think that this is becoming more and more relevant as time moves on with just the way that our society is. Not just Dutch Bros, but life is a marathon and it's not a sprint. Skyler, he just got picked for, Arizona. I've had this talk with him over the years. So he worked for us for 12 years. And so for me, I've had multiple times where I'm like, dude, take your sprinter shoes off and put your marathon shoes on. This isn't happening overnight. And I think some people think that, particularly in Dutch Bros, it's like, okay, I've been here for a year. I want to move up. What more can I do? What more can I do? I'm totally. Always getting told that. And there's only so many managers and assistant managers and shift leads that we can have.
Yeah.
But if you can be patient and continue grinding and just putting in time and being that person that your manager can depend on and, like I said, and caring, you're going to stand out and you're going to be the guy that people want to work with. And that's another thing that I've told my crew before is be that person that everybody else wants to work with and you're going to go far.
Yeah.
How many people do we have work for Dutch Bros now?
10,000 roughly, I think.
9 to 10,000 almost. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I hope every one of them listens to this.
Oh, that'd be amazing.
This is the one thing that I wish every person that works for Dutch Bros could hear. And it's realizing the impact and the weight that you carry in your communities. And the thing that I've used with my crew, because of how relevant it is, you think about the car fire. That was what they called the fire that happened in Redding. And you think about the campfire, which is the one that happened and is happening in Paradise.
Yeah.
Everybody thinks about that. And they think about this mass destruction and this huge fire and all the damage that it did. Those two fires, they started with a spark. And that's the thing that our crew needs to realize is that they're a spark at the window and that they're making such an impact in their communities. And they may never even see the impact that they're making. Mm-hmm. But to realize that they're that spark to that major fire that is going to make change in communities. And that's what I've been really talking with our people about is all this negativity that's focused around Reading, but our people have so much power to start that fire of change in our community by blessing one person at a time at the window. And it's, you can't turn it off, And so it's just being that spark.
Great advice. And dude, thank you so much. We've taken up a lot of your time and dude. I could talk to you for hours, so don't let me do that.
I love this stuff.
Thank you so much. Appreciate your insight. And I appreciate you sharing kind of the state of Reading and the state of Dutch Bros down there after some really intense, heavy stuff. Yeah. It's great to hear your guys' voice and that Aaron's city council now, so you guys can just extend that reach and just keep showing more love. Like, we're all super proud of you, bro.
Yeah.
Like, big time.
Well, thanks. Thanks, man. I appreciate that. It means a lot.
Yeah. And give Aaron a big hug and tell her congrats and
good luck in her first meeting.
Yeah. Take it on. Be strong.
No, tonight's the night.
There you go.
Thanks again, bro. Oh, we love you, man.
All right. Yeah. Good chatting with you guys. Later, dudes.
Later.